Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
All right, that's right. I don't know why, but I always get a giggle at the beginning of the show, which I think is a nice way to start. You know, when they say that you can hear a smile on somebody's face when they're talking. And so, yes, I'm smiling because I love doing my show. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. This is the Heritage Radio Network. And we are proud, proud, proud to be sponsored by Heritage Foods USA, one of my all-time favorite companies. Check out their website. They really have some amazing products on there. And now that I've finished writing my book about meat, which has just landed in bookstores, thank you very much. What's the Matter with Meat? You can hear me talking about it on Jenna Liut's excellent show, Eating Matters. She interviewed me yesterday, and it was a fine time was had by all, at least by the two of us in the studio anyway. But anyway, so today we are going to be talking with Jamie Schwide, and Jamie is deep in the heart of food service. He runs a company that does basically sells ground meat and nothing but. And we're going to talk about trends in the burger business and also sort of the joys and sorrows of opening a new plant and so forth. But before we get to that, we're going to do this, and that is my own joys and sorrows. So I have an interesting tidbit to tell you right now, which is that the New Mexico Attorney General, and this was in a lot of different publications, you might even have seen it yourselves, launched a probe into the cattle industry for price fixing. Now, this includes reviewing the current federal regulatory schemes and the use of New Mexico law, and they're going to use New Mexico laws to investigate giant out-of-state corporations. Why? Well, because the packers are beating the price down on growers to the point that they cannot survive. This is endemic to the meat industry, which you would learn if you read my book, due to consolidation, which we've talked about quite a bit on this program. When there are only a few packers who control 80% of the entire industry, you can see that growers are basically at the mercy of their processing and their pricing. So I'm hoping to get this Attorney General, Hector Balderas, I think his name is, to talk about the case. So far, his office has not responded, but I will keep after them because that's the kind of person that I am. This is happening, by the way. Remember that we talked with Chris Leonard a few months ago about price fixing in the poultry industry. This is what happens when you have monopolies. These guys are controlling all the pricing, both to grocery retailers and also to the people who are growing the food. So, there has to be some invocation of the Sherman Act or some sort of antitrust legislation, which, of course, I think we can all assume pretty safely will not be happening under this administration, unless there is tremendous support from other attorney generals and so on in bringing these cases to court. So anyway, that's that story. And as if the wildfires in Oklahoma and Kansas, remember I did a show a few weeks ago about the Panhandle Relief Organization, a grassroots organization that was bringing bales of hay and forage to Colorado, Texas, Kansas, Oklahoma, all of which had been decimated in these terrible wildfires in March. There was a massive blizzard this past week. I think it dropped something like 2.5 feet of snow across Oklahoma and Kansas, and has led to thousands of deaths of cattle. In fact, they haven't even counted them yet. I mean, people who are generally sort of small-scale cattle producers who have them out on pasture already, it being spring and whatnot. You know, if you owned 250 head, you might have, I don't know, maybe 120 left, if you're lucky. Those were some of the figures that I saw. So, like, some of the cattle would find a windbreak and stay huddled together, and others would just get lost in the blinding snow, wander off, and freeze to death, because believe it or not, cattle actually need to be protected from weather. In addition, the blizzards, by the way, also crushed the wheat crop in Kansas, and Kansas produces about 60% of the crop for the entire country. So that's, 80% of the crop for the entire country. So that's a fairly significant loss as well. So I think it's safe to say that climate change is having an impact on our farming sector in a big, bad way. So we're going to hope that somebody pays attention to climate change, but I don't think it's going to happen.
And then my last item today is just to stay on the Midwest for a minute. AgWeb, which is a wonderful agricultural, publication that I read fairly regularly, has a slew of stories about the incredibly high levels of nitrates in drinking water that come from agricultural runoff. And what's interesting is that while some of the towns seem to be perfectly happy having to rely on bottled water for drinking, which I guess they get for free, there is also considerable worry about the fact that unpotable drinking water reduces their property values. Well, duh. So even though these voters tend to be ardent supporters of Trump and long for the EPA to go away, they still want federal money to build a new water treatment plant. So go figure. I mean, I don't get these voters. I just don't get them. Like, why would you not want the EPA to help you as, you know, do what needs to be done to clean up the drinking water? I mean, these people are not really thinking very clearly. And it's very similar to the situation that's happening in Des Moines, Iowa, which, and we've had that guy, Bill Stowe, on the show two or three times now to talk about. First, he sued the upriver counties. He lost. He took it to federal court. They dismissed. And now they're trying to basically put him and his, and the Des Moines Water Works out of business and put it under state control so that they can just basically pollute with impunity. And, you know, this kind of thing has to stop. There has to be some regulations on this. And this the lobbying arm of these big mega agribusinesses is obviously so powerful that even state governors fail to protect their populations from these, these people who pollute with impunity. I'm sorry. Anyway, we're going to take a quick sponsor drop. We'll be right back with Jamie Schwide, the president of Schwide & Sons, a premier burger maker. And we'll be talking about trends in the industry. I can't wait. He's been on the show before, so stay tuned.
Heritage Foods USA is a farm-to-table online butcher and founding sponsor of Heritage Radio Network.
Heritage Foods got its start when Patrick Martin's first stepped foot onto Frank Reese's Kansas farm in 2001. Back then, Frank was the only farmer in America raising true heritage turkeys with recorded lineages tracing back more than 150 years.
Patrick knew instantly he'd found a unique moment, an opportunity to go beyond acknowledging these breeds as being jeopardized and to actually do something to save them. Patrick asked Frank to ramp up production and made a promise to him that if he would raise them, Heritage Foods USA would sell them.
That was the moment that Heritage Foods' slogan, "Eat 'em to save 'em," was born. By creating a market for delicious meats from heritage breeds, we can ensure they'll be around for generations to come.
Plus, heritage breeds just taste a whole lot better. Learn more at heritagefoodsusa.com and use the code HERITAGERADIO for 2 free pork chops with your first order, brother.
Yeah, and trust me when I tell you, you'll want those pork chops. They are fabulous. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. This is the Heritage Radio Network. And we're going to be talking today with Jamie Schwide. Jamie is the president of Schwide & Sons, a family-owned fourth-generation ground beef purveyor. Jamie works alongside his father, David, and his brother, Brad, to bring you the very best burger to consumers by offering a range of high-quality ground beef blends. Welcome back to the show, Jamie. Thanks for joining me.
Katie, how are you today?
I'm good. It's nice to hear your voice again. Remember, you were on like 3 years ago.
Oh, I remember well. It was great.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about the growth of the burger category in the last 15 years, just to kind of set up what's been happening in that part of the segment of the restaurant industry.
Let me jump into that in a second, but I really appreciate and enjoy the news that you shared in the beginning of the telecast, because it's very present in our business today.
I would think so.
Yes, with what's happening in the Midwest with these volatile weather. And it's really driven up the prices of beef over the last couple of weeks significantly. So it's really a timely conversation with Memorial Day coming quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, why don't we stick on that topic for a second? Just how much, what kind of percentage are you talking about in terms of the price of beef? Because the supply was tight already, correct? And then now we have these, you know, additional casualties in the cattle market. What kind of percentage are you seeing in terms of raising prices?
Oh, I mean, it's astronomical. 50, I mean, the markets have gone up 40, 50, 60% some areas.
Wow.
And just so you know, the actually cattle supply has loosened up significantly over the last 6 to 9 months, probably maybe a little longer than that. If you look at the cattle on feed numbers, they've increased. And substantial in our business is, 2 to 3%, but, you're seeing a lot of cattle available. But like you said, what's hurt us over the last couple weeks has been this huge storm that hit the Midwest and this rampant snow that has killed a lot of cattle and has hurt the supply. And I don't know that we know the effects of this today. It'll probably take some weeks to really figure out what the full implication is of these storms.
Yeah, I agree. And plus the wildfires before that. So there was a lot of cattle lost in those as well. I haven't seen any numbers specifically, even though I look at the papers, I look at the trades quite a bit to try to find that stuff out. But I don't, especially with the blizzard, I don't think they've really counted up. I don't think the ranchers themselves are really aware, because a lot of the cattle were out on range. And that's why they couldn't get them in, into a sheltered position before the storm hit. I gather it came on pretty fast.
Yeah, and it's also a very, independent business. So you have, it's very tough to get all the information reported when you have a ton of independent ranchers and farmers to report that information to data services.
Yeah, because this is cattle that before they go to a feedlot, this is not, this is not confined area, concentrated area feeding operations that suffered these losses.
Correct.
These are the guys who are the stocker feeders or the cow-calf operators, and they generally tend to be much smaller entities. And that's why there's so many of them, right?
Yep, exactly. It's a very, very, I'm very interested and choose to read your book because it seems to touch upon a lot of those points where you have a largely independent the base of business that's selling to a large conglomerate large companies, but only four or five of them.
Yeah, exactly.
That vast part, yeah.
Yeah, I have a whole chapter on consolidation. In fact, if you listen, the first item I read about was this guy in New Mexico, the attorney general, who's looking into suing some of those big players for price fixing, because they're killing those ranchers. They're not paying a fair price because the guys have no place to go with their cattle to process them. How does that play out for somebody like you? How does that play out for your segment of the industry in terms of the consolidation? Because, we're going to go right off topic here, but you know how the poultry industry is being sued by grocers and retailers for price fixing? So do you feel like that stuff is happening in the cattle industry from your end of it, as well as them beating the prices down for the ranchers?
Well, I think the big difference in the two industries is the vertical integration piece. In the chicken business, it's much more vertically integrated.
Yeah.
And in addition, the life cycle of a chicken is much faster than cattle.
Sure.
You're doing it 3 to 5 years. So there could be an opportunity to maybe have some more price fixing that goes involved in chicken as opposed to beef. I don't know that it necessarily affects our business, only in the sense that it's supply, right? So our big concern when the cattle has, when there's not enough cattle on feed, that we're always looking for more supply. And I think that as the last 12 months have gone for us, hopefully in the future, that with more cattle on feed, the situation between the cattle ranchers and the packers, we'd like unity, we'd like harmony, we'd like for everybody in the whole supply chain to make money.
Right.
And I'm hoping that continues. I mean, the challenge we have is the volatility, like you said, where like right now the calf producers are doing really, really well. Live cattle is up to almost record numbers again, and the packers now they're hemorrhaging money. And then it's a very vicious cycle, and we somehow have to figure out economically how everyone in the supply chain can make money and not have these volatile movements up and down, because those cause tremendous issues for cow producers, for the packers, and then for us ground beef processors, because ultimately for us to then pass that cost along to the retailers or to the food service customers is nearly impossible. None of our customers are going to take that type of increase. We have to really slowly move the prices up, and for us then it's a financial deficit.
Let's go back for a second to what you just said about how the packers are hemorrhaging money when the cow-calf producers are making money. How does that work?
Well, so if you look at the cost of cattle today, right, that's what the cat-calf producer sells the animal to the packer for.
Uh-huh.
And the higher that cost is, the more money the packer has to generate from the carcass cutout.
Uh-huh.
And so if the packer can't go to the retailer or go to us and say, okay, we're going to increase our middle meat 20%, we're going to increase our ground beef 10 or 15%, or there's no demand for that product, what ends up happening is that they get stuck having to sell that product at a cheaper price. So ultimately, the whole carcass, the whole cutout piece, doesn't add up to what they're paying for the cattle.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Interesting. But isn't it true that they very much control the price per pound that they give to the producers, to the stocker feeders?
So I don't have that much knowledge in terms of how that works. Because our business typically is we're dealing primarily with the packers, not with the calf producers. So that I can't really speak to.
Okay. Yeah, because I mean that's what that suit in New Mexico is all about. It's the fact that because there are so few processors, they basically can dictate price and schedule to the producers. And that's what the producers are screaming about. And that's what the whole GPSA thing is about. You know, the whole, right? All those GPSA rules that were supposed to come into effect that haven't, blah, blah, blah. And there's a whole RCAF and all these other organizations that are crying foul about how the consolidation of the market is killing them. So I think it's interesting to hear that, you know, on some level, the packers are also taking a beating. I'm still not understanding exactly. I mean, I heard what you said, but it's still not completely adding up to me. But anyway, I'll have to read up on that, Jamie.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's a very
complex equation, right? I mean, there's nothing easy about this.
Oh, my gosh. It is so complex about, you know, how both sides, whether it's the packer or the cash cow producer, because of the long cycle.
Yeah.
And this 3 to 5 year cycle of raising cattle, especially grain fed cattle, is, you know, causes sort of these, again, you know, the volatile day to day movements when it's really a market that takes months and years to fundamentally shift.
Right. Sure. Right. And then on top of that, you have all of the speculation on the commodity market. So you don't know what your cost of feed is going to be. Right. So you have like all of the fluctuations in corn and soy and, you know, some of the other oil seeds and grains that they use for cattle feed. It definitely has a lot of moving parts. But let's go back to Schweid and Sons for a second. Let's do our infomercial. Tell us about. So you guys the reason I invited you onto the show was to talk about your expansion. You just built a new plant in Georgia, right? And so so that means the burger business is clearly thriving. Tell us about the plant and what has happened. What has changed in your business that encouraged you to make this big financial step?
Well, I always joke to friends of mine when we talk about the expansion that, you know, we're a 40-year overnight success. You know, my father started the business 40 years ago,
right,
making ground beef, and, you know, it sort of had its moment, right? And the last 10 or 15 years, it's having its moment. And, you know, over the last 15 years, you've had a couple things that have really promoted ground beef. You've had the creation of a better burger category,
right,
that the Five Guys of the world have created, which has created a demand for premium ground beef. Then you have the second piece, which is the economy, right? So when 2008, 2009 came about and the economic downturn hit, consumers have less money. And most in recessions, ground beef does really well because it's a lower-priced item.
Sure.
So it grew, and better burger categories grew. But what happened is that there hasn't been this movement back to steaks as significantly as we thought, and that has continued the growth in ground beef. And so it's been very exciting to see, this category, which, by the way, ground beef has been the largest category within the beef industry as well, continue to grow. Yeah, it accounts for, over 50% of sales at the retail, ground beef does.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah. So what happened was with our businesses, we grew, and, my father created some great relationships and great customers, and my brother and I were fortunate enough to continue those and grow our business. And ultimately what we found is that the plant capacity in New Jersey was filling up, and strategically we hired a company that looked at our business and looked at where our growth opportunities are, and figured that Atlanta, the Southeast, would be a great place for a new facility. For us, it's we're moving about 30% of our current business into that building, and it opens up some really great markets for us. So Texas, which we really haven't been that active in, allows us to go in and sell retailers and food service customers in Texas. And also, which I think is really important, is our existing customers. We're able to service those customers now in a much timelier manner. So we're making fresher ground beef that's getting to their, whether it's their retailer or whether it's to the restaurants, in a faster manner.
Now, when I spoke to you 3 years ago, I don't recall that you were selling so much into supermarkets, and now you seem to have a very big cohort of supermarket customers. Is that new, or is that something that's always existed and I just didn't realize it?
No, it's new. No, it's new. You know, our business was 100% food service.
Yeah, so I thought.
4 years ago, and, you know, we looked at our business and said, where can we find growth? And the food service business at that time was growing anywhere 1% to 2% net inflation. And, you know, we wanted to find areas where we think that there was growth. The other thing, which I thought was really, really interesting, is if you walk through a retail store, there's been no innovation in the ground beef space for 30, 35 years. Same ground sirloin. And we've been creating these custom blends and these high-end ground beef and burgers for our customers in food service, and for some reason it didn't translate over into retail. So we looked at it and said, here's a great opportunity to sell to retail consumers custom blends that they're consuming already in food service and sell them at the retail level. So it's been, truthfully, we're so overwhelmed with the success. I mean, it's been unbelievable. It's been great. I'm like shocked at how successful it's been.
Yeah, I think you're a genius. I really do. I mean, I don't understand why other people didn't like glom onto that when the burger thing just took off. What was it, like 10 years ago?
Yeah.
Anyway, well good for you, Jamie Schwide, for figuring that one out. That's brilliant. So you actually...
Yeah,
go ahead.
No, I'm saying, you know, I'd like to say brilliant. It's just, you know, if you're in a business and you're focused on your business specifically, you know, it's almost like things like Uber. Like, those are things that after the fact make complete sense. I'm like, how come someone didn't think about it? It's like the same thing with me. We just had an aha moment in the office, and we're like, why don't we try this and see what happens?
Now, let me ask you, how did you sort of create, I mean, do people buy the brand? It says Schwide & Sons, right? It's not Better Burger.
Correct.
So how do they know, like, they just see, like, a nice-looking piece of packaging, and it says, you know, this is like a special custom blend of blah, blah, blah. And the consumer is sufficiently educated about that to understand that that's going to be a better value, or at least a better flavor experience than your traditional ground beef. I mean, have you done any consumer, marketing?
Yes.
Okay, so tell me about that.
Your questions are yes. And I'll give you the quick story. So
sure.
When we first got our first retail customer, we shipped the product in, and I turned to my brother and father, and I said, we're screwed. And they looked at me and go, why? I go, I don't know who's going to buy this.
Right.
No one knows who we are. We're a food service brand. You know, no one's ever heard of us. But what we found is, later on when we've done consumer testing and trials, is that the packaging has created trial at the store. So they see a nice, beautiful sleeve that we do that looks like butcher paper, mm-hmm. and the consumer says, wow, this must be a good product. So that's initially how we created trial. Now we've, what we've done is we've put a big marketing campaign towards education, just like you've mentioned, about the cuts of beef that we're using in the product, or, you know, in the retail product, the taste profile, et cetera. So we've done a big upgrade of our packaging to really educate the consumer. And then also from our website to our experiential events that we're involved in South Beach, in Boston, we're really getting out this message of education. And I think that, like, your show, for example, the consumer is demanding more education on their product, and we feel that we're ultimately very transparent in who we are and what we do, and I think it's a big plus, you know, in this world today.
Oh, I think so. I mean, one of the things that I know a lot of people worry about in terms of ground beef, and I know that you buy beef from Australia, or at least you used to, is country of origin labeling.
A lot of consumers are very worried about where their burger meat has come from. Are you able to like address some of those concerns in your packaging?
Yes, we can. I mean, we can talk about the cuts of beef. We can, you know, it's not mandatory anymore to,
right.
to put country of origin labeling on your product. But I think that that's ultimately what how we're going to succeed in this business, in the ground beef business, because there's a lot of there's a lack of transparency. There's a lack of information.
Yeah.
And I think for us to go overboard with that information. So, you know, we have a grass-fed program out there right now, and it's all domestic. Is that something that we made a commitment to?
Right.
You know, on our products there. And, you know, we have our whole muscle cuts that we do for our blends, and those are all domestic cuts of beef. So we make an effort and a concerted effort to get that education out there. And I think what's made us successful in the industry is just to take the approach of, hey, you know what? We are who we are, and this is what we do, and we want to educate you, and we're open to, you know, consumer feedback, but, you know, we want to tell our story and our narrative to our customers. And part of that is, like you said, is sharing with the customers, you know, where that beef comes from.
Uh-huh. Absolutely. So who in general are your suppliers? You have new suppliers in the South or the Midwest? The South, I don't think of as cattle country. So, but are you buying from ranchers in Texas, for example, or?
But you'd be surprised, actually, about the Florida, from what I'm told, has one of the largest cattle supplies in the country.
I did not know that.
Yes, I didn't either. I actually had to question it, and then I was proven wrong. So what we've done is here's our thought process. So we buy a lot from the larger packers that are probably mentioned in your book. You know, we are believers in a lot of the quality control points that they adhere to, and I think a lot of it also has to do with the money they put into food safety. We do purchase from some smaller suppliers that are regional based, but as your book will is probably shown, and I haven't read it yet, but I can imagine there really isn't that many suppliers left to buy from.
Nope.
that we qualify as safe, as safe and quality beef, and so
right.
You know, we're hoping that more and more. You know, folks come into the marketplace and packers so that we continue to have more supply.
Well, I don't think the packers are going to be welcoming any new. I mean, I was going to ask you about vertical integration for your company. For example, in other words, buying directly from suppliers and bypassing the big industrial, megalopolies. Is there any chance you would ever do that? Or you buy whole cuts of meat and then you grind them to your specific blends? That's how your plant works? That's what you do?
Yeah, I think, though, what's unfortunate about our business today is that we can't drive a lot of innovation or change because the packers are these big entities. But I think what's happening, which has been very, very surprising, and also I think encouraging, is the big food service restaurants. Those are really driving change
yeah.
with the packers. So whether it's GMO or cage free. So what we're starting to see is more of that coming into the marketplace. And you know, for us, our natural business and our grass fed business is growing exponentially now. The base of business is obviously much smaller than what our commodity business is, but
sure.
It's growing. And what has happened to us in the past has been the supply constraint. So the fact is, we've been selling natural for 10, 12 years, but we ran up against some supply issues, and those are starting to go away as as everyone's joined sort of Chipotle and using natural beef, organic, and all of the what I like to call the confusing nomenclature on packaging.
right?
that only someone like me knows because I get paid to do it it's my
right.
job.
Right, right.
It's driving the packers to start to produce more of natural product, and I think it's going to help over time. Again, like we talk about, I've talked about a couple times this 3 to 5 year cycle. You'll start to see more and more natural product come to the marketplace and grass fed as well.
Right, right. So what's the difference between grass fed and natural, Jamie?
Well, so the devil's in the details, because not all grass-fed is natural product.
Meaning natural, right? Means what, though? I mean, because to me, natural means absolutely nothing. Natural means no
yes.
water, no additives. I mean, that's the technical
okay.
term.
Yes.
So what are you saying when you say natural?
Okay, so that's right. So the technical term, is, for natural, is, like you said, no additives, preservatives. So theoretically, for all the retail product that we sell, we can put all natural on it because we don't have any additives in our beef. Right. However, that to me is misrepresenting what actually natural means in the beef business, which is no antibiotics, steroids, or hormones that are involved in the product.
Uh-huh.
So. But within that, there's also two definitions. There's what's called a withdrawal program,
right.
And there's called just a pure all natural. Our products are all natural. We don't subscribe to the withdrawal program, but that's what it is. So grass-fed can be natural, right, if there's no antibiotics or hormones, but there also can be grass-fed that is not natural. If, let's say, a steroid or which probably wouldn't be needed, but like an antibiotic is included in the, you know, in the animal.
Right, right. I mean, like prophylactic antibiotics for growth promotion.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes. Yeah, so, well, yeah. So, you know, let's say the cattle, the grass-fed cattle on feed gets sick. They have to treat that animal, and
for sure.
And so they would use an antibiotic. So that means it's still grass-fed, but it's not, you know, all natural antibiotic free.
Right. Right. Although I would consider it antibiotic free, I have to say. I mean,
okay.
You know, I mean, just my own thing. I mean, to me, you know, the use of antibiotics as a prophylactic is a completely different animal from treating an animal when it's sick with an antibiotic on a one-shot basis. You know what I'm saying? I think that's those are two very different usages. And by the way, now that the Veterinary Feed Directive is coming online and they are going to be obliged to stop using over-the-counter products and only use antibiotics when they're prescribed by a veterinarian, I think that's going to have a big impact on the business. I don't know quite what, but I think it's going to be interesting to watch. One of the things that really interested me was your to go back to sort of like the point that you were just making about, you know, your brand differentiation. Your publicist conveyed these various stats to me. Sales of conventional meat last year grew less than 3% in value compared with a 12% uptick for meat labeled natural and 23% gain in sales of meat labeled antibiotic free. So that's basically what you guys are doing. And you're kind of in a way capitalizing on that trend because you've been able to secure suppliers who can create that product stream for you on a regular basis. Can you talk a little bit more about how you kind of sourced that out? Because obviously that was not something that was, you know, antibiotic free, especially that was not readily available, shall we say. That was very much a niche product only just a few years ago. So talk a little bit about how that sort of that trend is expanded and why that's been so useful to you guys. Not to be redundant or anything, but, you know.
Yeah. No, if you looked at we've studied and looked at the what we like to call the customer journey, and we look at the not only the millennial. I think that there's a lot of tension going to millennials, but also the Generation Y as well, that or Generation X, excuse me. That they're very educated, and they're also concerned about their food supply and.
Right.
You know, whether it's the Whole Foods of the world that are, you know, that have emerged and or walking into a conventional retailer now that has a fully stocked organics program. You know, the cost of natural and the cost of some of this product has come down in pricing because of scale.
Right.
And so now that there's more of these food service companies on there that are driving the volume, what's happening is the cost has come down. And so now the consumer, although still has to make a value proposition of do I want to pay X amount more for organic or natural product, the prices have come down enough where and more people are making that decision. And so what's happening for us is, which has been great, is, you know, we've partnered with these, you know, natural suppliers for the last 10 or 15 years.
Uh-huh.
It just hasn't been a large part of our business because there hasn't been supply available.
Right.
And now that's so, you know, probably 7-8 years ago, you know, we sort of stopped adding new natural clients because our supply chain just stopped, and they said, look, we can't, because we're ground beef, right? So we're just a small part of the animal. The middle meat, which is where all the you know, the price is at. So, you know, you're $8, $9, $10. There hasn't been a tremendous amount of demand on the middle meat. There wasn't back then. Now that seems to be picking up steam. So what's happening is I mentioned it before with the whole animal, the carcass cut up. So they're getting value. They're getting consumers paying a premium for not only the end meats, the ground beef, the roast beef, the, you know, things like that. They're also getting it for the middle meats, the the strips, the ribeyes, et cetera. So
right.
It's now that there's more supply, it allows me to go out to retailers and to food service customers to sell more of this supply.
Right, right. So you don't see yourself ever becoming, not working with a middleman, but working with it directly with like a White Oak Pastures or something like that? You don't ever see your company? Because now that you're in Georgia, I'm thinking, my God, got the ultimate and fabulous beef quality is right there at your fingertips.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that we're part of what I think has made us successful is that we are looking to innovate in any way possible.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and be at the forefront of where the markets are. So there's no reason that we wouldn't partner with, a White Oak Pastures or someone like that. I think, where as long as we're only responsible for grinding up ground beef, if we were involved in the whole animal, we don't have outlets to sell all the middle meats and everything else.
Right.
So that's why it's tough for us to get involved in what's called in the industry a cattle pack program, where you're, in essence, buying the cattle and you're
right.
You're using the pieces and selling the pieces you have and whatever else is available, the packer or the fabricator would sell off. I think that as our business evolves, there'll be more of those White Oak Pastures and those type companies that we'll partner with regionally because we've just launched a local program as well. And so we're looking for local suppliers that we can, walk into a food service customer or a retail customer and say,
right.
This is local beef to Georgia. This is local beef to New York, New Jersey, or South Carolina, or whatever it is.
Uh-huh.
And so that they can, support their local farmers or ranchers. So it's starting. I mean, again, it comes back to supply. I mean, we have a program today. In New Jersey, that we launched, that's doing okay. In about 6 months, we'll launch one in Georgia. We'll try to find a partner in the Georgia market,
uh-huh.
so that we can sell this local. We can sell local supply because we want it to be local. We want it to be ground locally and sourced locally. Not hey. I'm selling a customer in Jersey, but I bought the meat in Iowa.
Right, right, right. That is difficult, though, to go back to what you were saying about, so a large part of an animal winds up as ground beef. There's no question about that. But, you have to partner basically with the packer and say, I want the ground meat part, but you get the rest and you sell the rest. And that, I would imagine that's quite a challenging equation to, parse. I think it sounds pretty tough. But go ahead.
Everybody wants to sell the ground beef. That's why.
Yeah, right. Good profit margin on it, right?
It's where the most demand is. Not necessarily the highest profit margin,
uh-huh.
but it's where the most demand is, and it's quote unquote because it's the lowest cost product. It's the easiest product to sell.
Right, right. I think this is fascinating because, probably 7 or 8 years ago, the every other block was opening a new steakhouse, and it was all about steak, 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 steak. And I know, do you know the guys at DeBraga and Spittler here in New York, George Faison and Mark?
Do.
Yeah, really great guys. I mean, they made a fortune on that. I mean, or at least they expanded their business hugely because so many steakhouses were coming to them because they did that custom aging program. And it's sort of interesting that. Obviously they're still doing very well, but it is fascinating to me that the rise of the steakhouse has kind of seen its better days, I would say. And it's really more about Shake Shack and, all the kinds of stuff that you all are doing.
Well, it's like every market, right? It goes on its run, it expands too rapidly, and then you start to see contraction in the market, just like casual dining is today. And then the great operators will survive, and it'll be a good business to be in a couple of years again.
Right. Fascinating. So talk a little bit about what it took to open this new facility. Did you have to, was it difficult to get permits? Did you have to jump through some sort of hoops? Were you offered tax incentives to establish a business in Georgia? Who did you deal with and how did that work?
So it was a long process,
uh-huh.
a long journey, but all of those things that you mentioned are correct. When we looked to source a building, we were creating jobs in a marketplace. So we were able to partner with there's a tax credit that the government offers that they were able to provide us, which was great. And then also the state of Georgia and the Fulton County, which is where the facility is really phenomenal at generating jobs and generating. Growth. So they, uh-huh. they have been phenomenal in helping us out. So they've assisted us in some tax rebates there. The Fulton County has been really great to work with in terms of in terms of our business. So whether it's Georgia Power, you know, getting, because we had to get additional power into the building, right, or getting permits. So none of those issues were problem. Actually, the only issue we had was with Comcast, to be honest with you.
Really? So getting internet.
Yeah, you know, it took us 6 months for them to run a fiber wire into our building. But
oh my god,
you know, yeah. But the what we did was, or what I, you know, my brother and I did was became insanely educated on a lot of facets of the business we never thought we would. So, you know, I flew internationally to find the best grinding automation system that we could find. And so I went to two or three different countries, looked at different equipment, products, et cetera, to really find the best source of equipment.
And you then mean also, you didn't go to the big show? There's a huge show in Atlanta that shows all of that stuff. I can't remember what it's called now, but I went to it two years ago. It was great. Anyway, so you got to fly internationally. You looked at equipment. Where did you buy from?
Well, so we ended up sticking with the equipment that we have purchased in our Jersey facility. But what we did was we automated our whole grinding system. So what we can do now is we can show our customers that when we promise a fat to lean ratio on our patties, that we can get it down to the 0.001%. We have a very, very expensive machine that analyzes every cut of beef that goes through, goes on our conveyor for any type of metal object, but also for our fat to lean ratio. What it also does, it's able to allocate our specific formulas to our forming equipment. So, for example, if we make 250 pounds of chuck brisket and, you know, 180 pounds of chuck brisket short rib, the meat is automatically allocated to, you know, our different forming equipment. So whether it's in a ground beef bulk or if it's in a patty, we know exactly what meat we made, where it went to, and how much weight was there. So we can assure our customers the exact precise formulas and product was given to them. And then also on the tail end of it, we're installing robotic automation for packing off. So what we identified is, you know, what are the two biggest factors for any organization right now? You have $15 minimum wage, and you have higher healthcare costs. So what we're looking to do is automate our facility, but bring in labor. We're actually not reducing labor. We're bringing in higher, more qualified or labor force that knows, you know, robotics, automation, but also understands demand planning and things like that. So the workforce demands have changed. And it's really moving our business in the 21st century.
That is fascinating. We could do a whole show on that, Jamie.
Yeah.
That is fascinating. We're going to have to come back to that topic because right now we have to wrap it up. So people can find out more about Schweid & Sons. I think you're just like an amazing business model to look at. Just because you guys have capitalized on a trend so successfully and clearly are continuing to do that. I hope the local programs work. I really do. That's such a good idea.
We're going to stick with it. I mean, you know, just like natural, we're going to stick with it. We know it. So it's like anything else. When you're first to market, it's going to be slow in the beginning. But we know that. But we're committed to it, and we know that it's something that's important. You know, for local programs and other things, you know, our website is a great resource to find out where our retail products are. We're in, I think it's about 5,000 retail stores. We just started selling Meijer in the Midwest. We're in ShopRite. We're in Key Food. We're in Grace's Marketplace. We're in, I know I'm going to miss, so I'm going to get in trouble.
I'm actually kind of surprised you're in places like Key Foods and ShopRite. Because I would have thought, I don't know what the price point is on your thing, but I would have thought you're a little bit high-end for those particular markets. I would have seen you more in a Wegmans, Grace's, obviously. It was an interesting mix on the website of what your retail customers' spread is. I thought that was a fascinating story in and of itself.
What we found is that we're an aspirational, we're an affordable luxury.
Right.
I mean, if you think about it, we're selling ground beef anywhere from $6.99 to $9.99, where your cost in the store today are, let's say, $3.99 or $4.99. So we're not looking to that. That's why, you know, when we walked into ShopRite, I was a little concerned. But if you walk around ShopRite in the beginning, they have a great value proposition. They have a lot of quality products that are, you know, that really they do a great job in sourcing. They have a great nutritional program. I think each store now has its own nutritionist.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I love ShopRite, actually. I think ShopRite's a great chain. There's like 17 of them, I think. And I think they're still family-owned. And they have a tremendous mix of ethnic products because of the wide base of, the wide diversity of their customer base. That I always enjoyed the store just looking around to see what they've got, especially in the meat counter, because they really have some weird, funky stuff, right?
Yeah, which is good, especially in the different ethnic areas. So whether it's they'll have kosher, they'll have halal, they'll have Hispanic array of products. They're really good at capturing the local market.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm going to say thank you very much for joining me today, and thank you to Heritage Foods USA for supporting the station. Thanks so much, Jamie, for being on the show again. Let's talk again about the whole robotics and the sort of change in the workforce thing. I'll call you in a few months, and we'll set that up, because I think that's a really interesting discussion to have about the future of food service and how all of these jobs are really kind of headed for the chopping block, and something totally new is going to take their place, right? And you guys are right in the forefront of it. So that's groovy. Thanks for listening, folks, and we'll see you next week. And thanks again, Jamie, and thank you to Dave, my engineer, as always. So long for now.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening. Searching for the